Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Parmenides review. So I'm giving this while I'm doing a walk, so you'll hear me breathing and various things like this. And just to give you context, I'm going rigorously through the philosophers at various points in time, just to unpack some of the science that I'm teaching, and you go through to work out what's being said. Now, it's not absolutely critical that you understand the philosophers. However, a lot of things which are said or taught are fundamentally misaligned or incorrect, and to unpick that requires a lot of effort. So if that makes sense, there's sort of, in a textbook, they'll say, oh, something like, Bruno agreed with so-and-so and got burnt at the stake, when we're looking at Galileo, or Newton said this, and I'll be wrong. And the simplicity of being wrong is, albeit simple, but it requires a lot of effort to unpack. And it's one of these things where, as you unpack, you go further and further back. That Newton competed with Descartes. Descartes, in relation to Newton, worked with Leibniz. Descartes was a dualist. Leibniz was a monist. And this all rates all the way back. And the different styles of theory. And so it's sort of like, there's a very simple mismatch of concepts. So it's sort of like being passed a mobile phone and saying, look, it's not very good. You open up the back and it's got different circuits, different batteries, different parts being all put in together. And it's all sort of quasi-logical, but it's because it's been made of different components and things forced to do different things. That requires a sort of a long-term view. Now, what happens is that when you go back into a philosopher and you've only just heard of it in passing, you've got no idea what's to come across. And it means that looking at one philosopher, you might only pick up one or two minor things. So looking at Plato, looking through that, he had dialogues which were basic film scripts. So Plato's a early Greek philosopher, and he had certain ideas which defined as people's Neoplatonists and the such. So these are philosophers new but taking off where Plato left. And there's a whole interplay of religion and various things like that. But then going down the track, the hill to Plato, it's then not much of a major diversion from someone writing out a film script or a play script to one of the subjects of his plays, which is, what is his name? What is it? Men's? Oh, look, this is one of the horrible things. It slips from my mind, the actual name of the person that I'm talking about. Stop for a while. I've got the last two syllables, but not the first syllable. And I've been podcasting like this, and it's, you know, the second syllable is M-C-M. So it's, what's that very first word? Well, you know, it's a podcast about this, and I'll be able to write about it. What I wanted to cover is some of the basic structure in the review. So we had Bertrand Russell's, who's a modern philosopher, is basically fused almost C++ with philosophy, and has written basically set theory notation for arguments, and has actually, Parmenium. It's okay. It's not the way I pronounced it. So it's interesting that it goes into your brain and it goes through. He's, all this really complex words about, you know, this long poem, where he's actually trying to, an ancient philosophical poem that he's trying to actually unlock this seemingly contradictory area of whether something exists if you can't name it or know it. And it's a negative existentialism. Existential is whether it exists or not, and negative, it's saying it doesn't exist. And so if you say something doesn't exist, you've said something, so that something's part of a set. And so Bertrand Russell, who used this analysis of this philosophy to say that such thing as a set name, a set which contains no members, is something which doesn't exist. It's like an empty set, so you can have a concept which is a set description and it has no members. And that sounds a very simple thing, and that gives you an example of how these philosophical problems are quite valid. They set things up and it gets solved by mathematics. What a good 2,300 years later it's set up, but without the mathematics to set it up, it's hard to go. And so so this is sort of an importance in that you've got this thing which is intractable, solved at a particular level, and people read it, they're going to go out to the front, teach 30 kids. Do they consider the complexity of it, or do they just go with what's written in text? And if the kid reads the textbook and produces what's in the textbook, everyone's happy. But it just means this contracting knowledge. Going back again, you've got this person who's it's this person writing philosophy in terms of plays, and before that, someone who's writing a semi-religious poem about how he goes up to heaven and the heavenly people explain things to him. He is something called, there's this idea of monism, or monism, and that is where you can't separate reality and God. It's all the same thing. And that's Pythagoras is the sort of famous monist, and Plato is this thing that we are all figments in some sort of giant matrix of God. And how is this person there's a D in there. I'll have to really remember it. It's just, is he a monist? What is a monist? And what is the monad? And it's sort of hard to do, because this is a philosophical question with a sort of scientific answer. You've got Descartes, further up. He's a French philosopher who's got mind and matter. He separates the two things out and has a series of logics. Newton avoids this all by saying, I feign no hypothesis. I just explain things with maths. That takes us away. But we have got this sort of almost monadism by field. Field theory is getting back to the monadism, and we've just got something slightly more complex, but not infinite. There's not an infinite number of fields, infinite number of forces. There's only, four main forces. Gravity, the electromagnetic force, the electro force, the weak force, and the strong nuclear forces. So it's not that, it's not infinite, it's not one, it's four. Now I just have to get those four forces in my head. There's obviously gravity, there's obviously the strong force, it's just the electro-weak force. I'll have to re-review all that knowledge and burn it into my head. So you've got all this philosophy, and people are sort of unaware whether it's true or not, or how it's linked up. They just refer to it, and they teach practically, some sort of iffy stuff. And where we're at is a different thing. So the monad, as drawn, which is a circle with a dot in it, is the existence of something. If you follow that theory, you get some wacky contradictions in supposed quantum mechanics, where the two things can be identical or non-identical. And in quantum mechanics, two things can indeed be identical, and that's because they are identical, their existence can resonate, or they can sort of tunnel and do all these sorts of things. But there's also a fundamental idea, the fundamental building blocks of matter. So what we've sort of come out at the end of it, we've sort of got this sort of three or four different tracks in the ancient world: monads, atomists. You've got the Epicureans, who believe the actual objects are independent, but they operate coordinated some form of coordination, which goes along biology. So science has come out the other end with sort of a really strange sort of combination. That's, you could say they're all right in terms of how it corresponds now. So we have the fundamental hydrogen atom, helium atom, and if you summed out all the types of atoms and all the type of stable isotopes. So let's say there's 120 types of possible atoms, but really only about 80, and it's really only about you'd be stretched if you considered the construction of anything, including isotopes. There's basically 1,000 types of fundamental particles which come together in different forms to form objects, and so there's this monadism is, well, physically wrong, and the idea of a thought is that we can now induce a thought in someone's head, or convulsion in someone with an electromagnetic pulse, and we can measure thoughts electrically. So in terms of the actual division between thought and existence, which is there, we can see that thoughts are a sort of a structure of neurons and things like that. So it's very interesting. The other thing is that philosophically, you have Schrodinger, who looks at all this and looks at the complexity of life and looks at the building, quantum mechanical building blocks, and says in his famous life lecture, this is before DNA, the DNA crystal, he said there has to be some sort of aperiodic crystal which determines organisms, programs the information. So there you go, in terms of the idea of philosophy inspiring informing science, and then science has some philosophical viewpoints which inspires philosophy. So we're going I think there's a D in there. I've got to go back and have a look at it, and so I'll read the next section. But it's a real opener to get down here, but that is to see how these things connect. So it's almost as though Bertrand Russell, who's providing the modern philosophy, which is, comes out with a series of mathematical statements which you map your philosophical statements to mathematical statements and therefore can solve them in a computer, so to speak. And he goes, stretches it back through all this palaver and actually makes a very precise comment of it, sort of oversteps the scholastic tradition. It's interesting to see you've got Bertrand Russell going at the top, but schooling is brought forward on very much the scholastic tradition. I trust my textbook as has been given to me by an authority. Eventually, people, I trust Paramens, Parid, I can't pronounce them. I trust him because he's an ancient person. I trust him because of this. And it's, scholasticism is sort of a necessary thing of sort of like, it's inductive reasoning on steroids, where you have inductive contradictory, so therefore it's sort of like a quality control of the information. I start with true facts, I can generate all true facts. If I generate a contradiction, I generate a quality control on what's above, which is a sort of a standard thing to do. So this, it's sort of scholasticism as a guide, as something to constrain, but not something to inform your understanding. And this is very much so if you believe that you have to be guided. The idea is to read just enough laws to get you through. If you read other stuff which perplexes you, it's hard to understand. So we'll get back to I don't remember of Aliad's power. Unfortunately, I can't visualise the couple of letters in the centre. I remember there's D, M, C, I, U, M. We'll get back to him and read the last section on him. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.